It is Tuesday, August 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, we'll speak to our correspondent in a Midwestern U.S. town where racial violence has flared a year after a controversial police shooting. We'll find out how China's surprise weakening of its currency affected global markets. Greece moves a step closer to a bailout for its debt-ridden economy. And Japan's island of Okinawa remembers a pivotal World War II battle with the Americans.
And then I thought, is this the enemy? I heard they were devils, and I saw his face, and he looked nice and said, I'm going to help you.
It's all ahead on International Edition. The Midwestern U.S. town of Ferguson, Missouri, remained under a state of emergency on Tuesday after a second night of violent protests marking the first anniversary of the shooting of Michael Brown. Brown was an unarmed black teenager killed by a white police officer during a street confrontation that brought national attention to complaints of police discrimination against African Americans in the United States. VOA's correspondent for the region, Kane Farabaugh, is in Ferguson and witnessed the second night of unrest involving protesters and local police. I spoke with Farabaugh today, and I asked him what he had seen on the streets the night before.
Well, this was the second night, and so there was obvious tension on the streets. Hundreds of protesters had gathered, and hundreds of police had also gathered, and really, it was in many ways controlled. Protesters did throw several frozen water bottles at police. They also, there were some reports that they threw some rocks. And this incident and this night, the police were not going to let these protesters gather any steam in trying to shut down traffic on the main avenue through Ferguson, West Florissant, which has been the site of riots and looting and destruction before. Whenever many of these protesters would try to take the streets and shut down traffic, police would move in and arrest those that didn't comply, and then move the rest of the protesters off the street. There were arrests made last night, not as many as there was during the day yesterday, and I would have to say that though it was tense and there were arrests made, the situation last night was a lot more organized and a lot more controlled, and it seemed as if the police were prepared, and that might be because they were prepared under a state of emergency that was declared yesterday.
Well, since you were there, who did you see as being responsible for the violence on the side of the protesters? Were they locals or outsiders?
I think many of the people that are here are locals. One person we talked to, in fact, said that he was a friend of Michael Brown. He wasn't out there being antagonistic. He was out there simply to explain that there are still things to accomplish in achieving equality. And actually, a comment he made to me, which is quite profound, is that, you know, Michael Brown's death was the shot heard around the world, and that shot continues to reverberate. Now, there are obvious people who are trying to capitalize on the media attention focused on this issue, and so there is a criminal element in the crowd that is antagonizing the police, and many of the protesters state that these aren't the kind of protests they want. They want the protests to remain peaceful, and they are against anybody trying to capitalize on these protests to turn them into a violent interaction with the law enforcement that's gathered there.
Now, I understand that after you left the streets, there were sightings of white militiamen called the Oath Keepers. What do people think about them?
Well, I think anytime you introduce men with guns into a very tense situation, it creates unease on everybody's part. So I think there was a widespread objection to their presence, certainly by those that were gathered there to protest, because the way that they're dressed, the weapons that they're carrying, it makes it uncertain why they're there and what they're going to do, and the fact that they've got weapons leaves everybody nervous.
Well, that was Midwest reporter for VOA Kane Farabaugh speaking with me earlier from Ferguson, Missouri. Well, it's time to check what's trending on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is with me in the studio. G, what have people been tweeting about regarding the protests in Ferguson?
Hi, Michael. A lot of things, and the best Twitter account to get up-to-date information on Ferguson is definitely the St. Louis County Police Department's account. Its handle is at STL County PD. He shared 14 tweets, including retweets, during the last 24 hours, and here's an example. It tweeted 16 hours ago, which was Monday night there, that officers are being hit with rocks and bottles. It added, "We continue to support free speech, but agitators who ignore orders to disperse risk arrest." The police department is also on Periscope, a video streaming app, so you can watch what happens live in Ferguson there.
Got it. Well, what if people... what are some of the hashtags that people have been using for these protests?
Well, hashtag Black Lives Matter is a big one, with more than 40,000 tweets using that hashtag during the last 24 hours. But an even more widely used hashtag is hashtag Ferguson, with nearly 130,000 tweets using that hashtag in the same time frame. Hashtag Michael Brown was used in about 2,000 tweets. That hashtag is, of course, referring to the African-American teenager who got shot, like you just mentioned in the intro.
Well, have there been any tweets on the first anniversary of Michael Brown's shooting from the U.S. presidential hopefuls?
Surprisingly, no, because even Bernie Sanders, who is quite vocal about racial issues, as you know, didn't tweet about the anniversary or the ongoing protest.
Got it. Well, thank you for the analysis, G. That was G. Abby Lee. And she is on Twitter. You can find her at her handle, at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Soybean oil is one of the most widely consumed cooking oils. But new research from the University of California, Riverside, suggests that a diet high in soybean oil causes more obesity than a diet high in fructose.
Most people think that one of the major contributors to the obesity epidemic is fructose.
But researcher Poonam Jotdeol says that in an experiment with mice, those mice on a high soybean oil diet gained twice as much weight as those that consumed the equivalent of fructose.
Soybean oil is found in almost all the processed foods.
The California researchers say that in addition to weight gain, the soybean oil consuming mice showed evidence of metabolic syndrome, a cluster of conditions that increase the risk of heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. China took a major step to revive its sluggish economy on Tuesday with a decision to weaken the value of its currency, the yuan. Alexis Christophorus, our business correspondent in New York, has been following that development, which has implications for economies around the world. I asked her earlier what impact the yuan's devaluation had on global stock markets.
Well, this was certainly a surprise move by China. It devalued the yuan by 2%. That's the most we've seen in two decades. And this came after data showed a plunge in exports and weaker than estimated manufacturing. Now, the People's Bank of China called this change a one-time adjustment that it says will better align its currency with supply and demand. But still, it sparked concern throughout the global markets that the world's second largest economy is headed for a deeper slowdown and that perhaps other countries will do the same thing with their currencies. We saw the news especially pressure companies that rely heavily on exports to China, like the automakers, like luxury good makers, and also Apple stock. I mean, that was one of the big losers on the day. It lost 5% because of its large exposure to China. Commodity producers, Freeport-McMoRan, Dow Chemical, also falling over concerns about China's growth. And, you know, something else here that could be at play is that China may be looking for a way to convince the IMF to include the yuan in its special drawing rights currency basket, and it thought that devaluing the currency would make it more attractive. So we'll have to see if the IMF moves on that.
I wanted also to ask about how the devaluation of the yuan affected the price of oil, which has been pretty weak recently.
Yeah, and it got weaker in the last session. It gave up another 3%, closing at $43.46 a barrel. Traders are worried that demand from China will slow and that a weaker yuan will really eat away at the buying power of Chinese consumers. China is the world's biggest consumer of energy and metals, and so we see crude sort of languishing now at this new five-month low.
Does the devaluation of the yuan give the U.S. Federal Reserve, which is the U.S. Central Bank, any reason to delay what's expected later this year, which is an interest rate hike in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Some analysts believe it may force the Fed to delay raising rates. There was talk they would do it in September. Now some are saying they may do this in December because the threat of a slowdown in China could harm global growth. And a rate hike would make the U.S. dollar that much stronger and make things much more expensive for other countries, including China, which we know is going through a slowdown right now. To put this in perspective, there was a new report out by Bloomberg, and it showed that the probability of a rate increase in September slipped to 44% from 54% after the yuan devaluation.
Okay, well, thank you to Alexis Christophorus, our business correspondent in New York, for that report.
My pleasure.
Well, staying with economic news, Greece and its international creditors have agreed in principle on terms of a new three-year bailout for the troubled Greek economy. Greece's parliament is expected to vote on the measure by Thursday, with Eurozone finance ministers potentially giving their support by Friday. Ken Bredemeyer has been following the Greek debt crisis on VOA's economics desk. International Edition's Susan Yaki spoke with Bredemeyer today and asked him about the significance of Tuesday's bailout agreement for the Greek government.
It's been a long fight to come to a new accord with its creditors, but today they reached a $94 billion bailout agreement. It's not quite done yet. It has to be signed off on by its creditors, such as its neighbors in Europe, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. But they needed to do this soon because Greece always seems to be up against some kind of a deadline. This time it's August 20th when they have to pay more than $3 billion back to the European Central Bank.
So there are some critics of this pact. What are they saying?
Critics would be, to a large degree, internal in Greece. Members of the prime minister's Syriza ruling party, who feel that he has turned on what he ran for election on, which was to do away with the austerity that this new agreement requires. Now, it appears, however, that there's not going to be enough opposition to the deal to kill it. It will pass with some Syriza support, as well as other Greek lawmakers from other parties.
And I remember when last time you visited us, you were saying some of the Greek people feel really put upon by all this.
Certainly that's the case. Austerity has a bad name in Greece at this point. It's even worse than that. Greece has gone through a tumultuous period and has had to previously impose lots of austerity measures. And this particular bailout requires even more tax increases, pension cuts, and cuts in government spending, which a lot of Greeks have depended on and feel because the earlier austerity didn't improve their lot much. They're saying, why should we endure more? But that's what this deal calls for.
Yeah. Perhaps you'll refresh our memories on what kind of situation in Greece has brought on the need for all these deals.
Greece has been in economic turmoil for 5 years now. This is the third bailout in that time. And if you put this one with the other two, it's now a total of $359 billion, which is a huge amount for a country the size of Greece. It's just 2% of the economy in the European Union, but is deeply in arrears, and it's going to be a long time before it can get itself cleared again. These bailouts, if you can think on it on a personal terms, it'd be like getting a new credit card to pay back old credit card debts,
yeah,
if people can look at it from their own personal lives. And that's why it's a very difficult sort of situation for the Greeks.
And that was Ken Bredemeyer of VOA's Economics Desk speaking with International Edition's Susan Yaki. Coming up after the break, we've got a look at the music world. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of scientists has spotted the most distant galaxy ever seen. Astrophysicists from the California Institute of Technology say that the galaxy called EGS 8P7 is the youngest such celestial object ever confirmed by spectrographic analysis. A spectrograph allows scientists to observe a spectrum of light or radiation from any source. This distant galaxy is being seen now as it was when the universe was less than 600 million years old. The astrophysicists say that finding galaxy EGS 8P7 provides new insight into how the universe evolved during its first few hundred million years of existence. They also say that the discovery brings scientists a giant step closer to looking back in time to the Big Bang. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. This Saturday marks the 70th anniversary of Japan's surrender to U.S.-led Allied forces in the Pacific Ocean, a move that ended World War II, the deadliest military conflict in history. The Allies and Japan fought over many islands and regions in the Pacific, but the Battle of Okinawa was one of the bloodiest and costliest of the war. VOA's Brian Padden recently visited the southern Japanese island to find out how that battle is being remembered.
The invasion of Okinawa was the last and one of the largest battles of World War II. It included an American naval armada of over 1,000 ships and hundreds of thousands of troops. The sustained fighting for 82 days that followed destroyed villages, incinerated forests, and killed close to 200,000 people. A small museum on a marine base in Okinawa preserves historical wartime photographs and memorabilia. The curator Mark Waycaster says in Okinawa, Japanese General Mitsuru Ushijima followed a guerrilla war of attrition strategy.
His goal here is not to win. He has no intentions of winning the Battle of Okinawa. His intentions is to bleed the American forces so bad that the United States sues for peace.
The high casualties and fierce resistance encountered in Okinawa were used to justify the decision to drop atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima to break the Japanese will. Today in Okinawa, many still remember the horrific battle that killed nearly one-third of the civilian population. Japanese military bunkers are preserved as memorials. The Himeyuri Peace Museum tells the story of nearly 200 schoolgirls who were conscripted to work as nurses for the Japanese military. Many died in the fighting. Shimabukuro Yoshiko was gravely injured during an explosion. She said the Japanese warned the girls that the Americans would brutally rape and kill them. Instead, she said, an American soldier saved her life.
And then I thought, is this the enemy? I heard they were devils, and I saw his face, and he looked nice and said, I'm going to help you.
Memories of the wartime devastation and loss of life have made many on the island outspoken pacifists, critical of both the continued U.S. presence on the islands and of conservative Japanese efforts to reinvigorate its military. Brian Padden, VOA News, Okinawa.
American singer Charlie Puth first gained international fame through the internet and his YouTube videos. Now he's about to release his first album and has a new duet with Meghan Trainor called Marvin Gaye. International Edition's David Byrd and VOA's Larry London talked about that song.
First, she had a hit duet with John Legend. Now Meghan Trainor is back with Charlie Puth, a tribute song, Marvin Gaye. Larry, tell me about this song.
It's a great song, and it's actually Charlie Puth's first solo release from his upcoming album, which is called Some Type of Love. It's an EP that is his first album ever. He's been a social media phenom. Back in 2009, he started putting stuff on YouTube and got very, very popular that way. And now he's got his own record. Of course, you know him from the number one hit See You Again, which spent 12 weeks at number one from the film Furious 7. It was a duet with Wiz Khalifa featuring Charlie Puth. Now we've got Charlie Puth featuring Meghan Trainor with Marvin Gaye.
Let's Marvin Gaye and get it on. You got the healing that I want. Just like they say in the song. Until the dawn, let's Marvin Gaye and get it on.
But if you want to hear Megan, I understand you might want to listen to this record because she's having some vocal problems again.
Yeah, again, this seems to be a reoccurring issue with a lot of different singers. She canceled a number of shows several months ago, resumed the tour. Unfortunately, as of today, she has postponed her tour again because of throat problems.
Now, is this going to require surgery, or do we know that yet?
Not known yet. It might. Like Sam Smith had a vocal hemorrhage on one of his vocal cords, and he underwent surgery and spent 2 months in rehab, so maybe Meghan Trainor will have to undergo the same situation. Who knows? A lot of these singers have throat problems. She's only 20, and her throat is not used to this kind of wear and tear because she's a songwriter, remember. That's how she came up through the ranks.
Yeah, she's not used to being in front of, you know, thousands of people putting on a show, because that can take its toll. I know that there's several high-profile country artists that Nikki Strong and I talked about who had the same problem. It's either a node or it's a like a callus on their vocal cords, or the blood vessels rupture, like Sam Smith. And that's nothing to be played with. You can literally lose your voice or do permanent damage to your vocal cords if you don't get that taken care of.
It's one of the hazards of the business that they're in, because when you have a popular song, you have to be out promoting it. And when it's popular on the charts, everybody wants you to perform it on their talk shows and in concerts and whatnot. So she probably, on average, I would guess any singer, sings a song when it's popular 3-4 times a day.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because one of my guitar heroes, James Taylor, said that Tony Bennett asked him, "Are you still doing your vocal exercises?" And he said, "No, not really." And Tony, who is now like 86 or 87 and still performing, said, no, you got to do that every day. You got to make sure you do that or you'll lose the voice.
Wow. I didn't realize that. Maybe I need to get that book.
Really? All right. Well, you know, if you have a comment about this, you can send Larry a tweet. He's at @VOA_music. Also, look for his show, Border Crossings. You can find that on our website, www.voanews.com.
And that does it for International Edition on The Voice of America. Today's show was brought to you by director Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling, and myself, Michael Lippin, in Washington. We'd love to hear from you. I'm on Twitter at @Michael_Lippin, and the program is there, too, at @VOA_IE. Bye for now.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The 69th session of the United Nations General Assembly adopted a resolution on July 30th committing countries to step up their collected efforts to address wildlife crime and put an end to the global wildlife trafficking crisis. The resolution was co-sponsored by the United States, Gabon, Germany, and more than 80 other nations. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash commended the United Nations General Assembly for its action. The UN resolution encourages countries to adopt effective measures to prevent and counter the serious problem of crimes that have an impact on the environment, such as trafficking in wildlife and wildlife products, as well as poaching. Action along the entire trade chain is encouraged, with member states urged to treat wildlife trafficking involving organized criminal groups as a serious crime, implement anti-money laundering measures, establish national-level interagency wildlife crime task forces, strengthen judicial processes and law enforcement efforts, prevent and counter corruption, and reduce the demand for illegally traded wildlife products from protected species using targeted strategies in order to influence consumer behavior. The UN resolution also strongly encourages countries to develop sustainable and alternative livelihoods for communities affected by trafficking of wildlife, encouraging the full engagement of the communities in and adjacent to wildlife habitats as active partners in conservation and sustainable use. This action underscores the global commitment to the fight against the growing illegal wildlife trade and those who threaten the future of many of our planet's species, said Director Ash. As a world leader in wildlife and natural resources conservation, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is committed to working with others to reducing illegal demand, dismantling trafficking networks, and ensuring that wildlife thrives for future generations. Wildlife trafficking is a global problem that demands a global solution. And we need to act now if we are going to save elephants, rhinos, tigers, pangolins, and other iconic species, Director Ash warned. The service is proud to work with foreign governments, non-governmental organizations, the private sector, community leaders, and concerned citizens to achieve this goal. This resolution will serve as a valuable catalyst for strengthened actions across the globe to put an end to the poaching crisis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.